Well, we only got one slide deep into this middle chapter. We're on slide two now. And what is the overall process that this chapter is all about? That's only part of the overall process. What's the overall process? Right, the complete oxidation of glucose. And it might be helpful to write this in your notes as kind of a hierarchy or outline form. This is the overall process, complete oxidation of glucose. And it has two major parts to it, which are glycolysis and then cellular respiration. And I'm leaving some room here. Well, actually, I don't. We haven't talked about the details of any of this, but we will. This is what I meant earlier, though, or just a minute ago, when I said cellular respiration is only part of the process. The overall process is complete oxidation of glucose. And oxidation is an important word there because that's how we use our fuels. That's how we extract the energy from our fuels, by oxidizing them. All right, fuels are molecules that are catabolized, broken down, for the purpose of releasing energy. So those catabolic reactions are, in other words, exergonic. We talked about this before, right? That's the release of energy. That's why we have our fuels, because we need the energy from them. We don't need the fuels for their own molecules. We need to release the energy so that we can undergo all kinds of endergonic processes. Now, the second slide is an example of a redox reaction. This should be review for you at this point because I started talking about redox in the lab because it applied to that day's activity. But remember, I told you that we're going to talk a lot more about redox. So I defined reduction and oxidation, which is what redox is short for. What is oxidation? It's the removal of electrons from something, right? And it's the opposite of reduction. So reduction is the gain of electrons. We see that happening here in this ionization that's occurring. Sodium and chlorine are both becoming ionized. They're turning into ions. But notice that it's sodium, which is the metal, that's becoming oxidized because it's having an electron removed. We talked about this in general for metals, right? They have a more empty than full outer shell, so it's easier for them to lose electrons. It's becoming oxidized. The chlorine is gladly taking the electron, so it's becoming reduced. Now, clearly, an ionization is a redox reaction, right? Because ionization, by definition, is addition or subtraction of electrons, which by definition is redox. But not all redox reactions are actually ionizations. Slide 3 is just a general scheme for oxidation. It doesn't represent anything in particular because X and Y aren't chemical symbols. But Xe minus simply represents something that has the electron, which is the E minus part, at the moment. Before the reaction occurs, Y does not have it. Well, it gets transferred to Y from X. So here, X is becoming oxidized, Y is becoming reduced. It's important to remember which one of these things is oxidized and which gets reduced, just in terms of the definitions of redox, which we've already covered. But in terms of energy, I want you to cement it in your brain that oxidizing something takes energy from it, because those electrons represent energy. And conversely, reducing something invests it in energy. because you're adding those high energy electrons to that thing that's being reduced. Now this goes hand in hand with what I've already told you about fuels. We oxidize our fuels, which means we are taking energy out of them. That's the reason they are fuels. They're sources of energy. And when we strip the electrons, which is what has to happen for it to be oxidation of the fuel, those electrons get put somewhere else. Remember, oxidation and reduction always happen hand in hand. So when fuels become oxidized, something else gets reduced. And what else gets reduced gets invested with energy. All right? That'll be important for the entire rest of this chapter. Actually, both chapters to come up. Let's look at an example, though, in slide 4 of a reaction that is a redox reaction, but actually is not ionization. In other words, a reaction can be considered to be redox even though there is not actually a transfer of electrons, a complete transfer of electrons. What we have here in the top row is the burning of a fuel. Now, when we say burning, that's really just everyday language for a specific kind of chemical reaction called a combustion reaction. A combustion reaction is just one example, one type of redox reaction, but it's the most important kind of redox reaction for this chapter, because that's what we do with fuels. We combust them. But combustion really refers to reacting some fuel, and in this case it's CH4, but it could be any organic fuel, with oxygen. And the general result of that, in other words, what happens when a fuel is combusted, reacted with oxygen, is that the products are carbon dioxide and water. All right, now CH4 is what? It's methane, which is the simplest hydrocarbon, right? Because it only has one carbon. It's an important fuel outside of biology, right? Can use methane. Methane is natural gas. It's what you burn in a natural gas stove. But there are all kinds of other organic fuels that are a little bit more complex, including glucose, which I've already told you is the master fuel. It's the most often used fuel in all biological cells. It's more complex not only because it has multiple carbons, so it has a bigger skeleton, but also because it has hydrogen and oxygen as well as carbon. Nevertheless, it's an organic fuel, and when you combust an organic fuel by reacting with oxygen, you still get the same products, just a different number of products. In other words, when you burn glucose, it will still turn into CO2 and water. Those are the material outputs. But of course, there's also the important output of energy, which is why you're burning this fuel to begin with, in terms of goal. You're trying to get energy out of it. But importantly, it's always the fuel in a combustion reaction that becomes oxidized. That's it. I've said this before. It's the oxygen that becomes reduced. All right, now, when we oxidize the fuel, by definition of oxidation, there is removal of electrons, but it doesn't have to be just an electron by itself like it is in an ionization. What we're really doing here is picking off the hydrogens from the carbon. But a hydrogen has an electron. So that's why this still qualifies as the fuel being oxidized, even though we're not taking only electrons from it. And the oxygen is receiving electrons in the form of hydrogen atoms that came from the fuel. And that's why it turns it into water. So in our body, We are producing water from the oxygen that we breathe along with the hydrogens that we pick off of our fuels. That's not water that you drank. That's water that we're making chemically as a byproduct of the complete oxidation of glucose. But the bottom row here shows you what's happening with respect to the electrons, which are what the dots are. And not all the electrons are shown, just the ones that are involved. But this hopefully will explain why hydrocarbons and others, carbohydrates as well, both of which contain a lot of CH bonds. This explains why CH bonds are valuable in terms of chemical energy, which is why you find a lot of CH bonds in fuels. It's because of something we've talked about many times already. Carbon and hydrogen have roughly equal electronegativities, which means that they equally share the pair of electrons that makes up the bond. Each of these pair of blue dots is a shared pair holding the hydrogen and the carbon together. Since they're equally shared, that means that shared pair of electrons aren't particularly close to either nucleus, right? And remember how important proximity to the nucleus is in an atom. The closer the electrons are to the nucleus, the lower the energy level, right? It's higher energy level the farther away you get. Equal sharing means they're not very close. So these are high energy electrons. When the reaction occurs, and obviously they're exactly equally shared in the oxygen molecule. Each oxygen is greedy, but they're equally greedy. So these ones aren't close to either nucleus either. Well, when the reaction occurs, the reason it occurs is because these electrons are trying to get to lower energy levels to be more stable. And in carbon dioxide, the oxygen is much more electronegative. So those electrons end up very, very much closer to a nucleus than they were before in the fuel. And water also features oxygen, which has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen, and therefore those electrons end up very close to a nucleus. So the electrons are going down in energy level, and that's why there is a release of energy. And that's why fuels feature carbon-hydrogen bonds. They have these high energy electrons in them because those electrons aren't, at the moment, as close to a nucleus as they would like to be. Okay, now we can actually talk about the fuel that is the main concern of the chapter, which is glucose. And in slide 5, this chemical reaction is, you can think of this as two ways. This is what would happen if you actually put flame to glucose. C6H12O6 is glucose. Now, glucose is not the only thing that has that formula, remember. Any hexose would have that same formula. But glucose is what we're talking about as the main fuel. If you actually combust glucose by lighting it on fire, then it will undergo this reaction in one step. The oxygen is being reduced, the fuel is becoming oxidized, and you get CO2 and water as the products. But all of the energy that's locked up in those bonds gets released at once. That's not what happens in a cell, though, because that would be a damagingly explosive release of heat that would kill the cell. So what we see here is considered to be a summary reaction. A summary reaction is written as though it occurs in one step when it actually doesn't. So this is a summary of a set of pathways that make up this entire process we're looking at in the chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose. This is the summary reaction that represents the complete oxidation of glucose. It's just that we don't see any of the intermediate details. All we care about is what we're starting with and what we end with after many steps. The reason it, in a sense, doesn't matter that we're ignoring all those intermediates is because in terms of delta G, it doesn't matter. Remember when we looked at the multi-step hydroelectric plant? I told you that the overall delta G for that multi-step was the same delta G as it would be if you did it all in one step. Similarly here, this amount of energy that's released in one step if you burn it is the same amount of energy that you'll get out of the fuel if you oxidize it just a little bit at a time and do it in many steps. But by releasing that energy a little bit at a time, it's much more manageable for the cell. First of all, it won't get killed by the explosive release, but it'll also be able to harness a maximum amount of that energy to do actual good for the cell, not just heat up. Instead, a lot of that energy will be harnessed to produce a bunch of ATP molecules. If you want to think about a goal for this whole process we're studying, the goal is to produce as many ATPs as possible from each molecule of glucose. Or I should say, from the energy released by one molecule of glucose. It's not that glucose gets turned into ATP. Glucose gets catabolized, releasing energy, and that energy can be used to make ATP. All right, now to six. It should be obvious that this reaction is not actually a complete reaction. Why is that obvious? What's wrong with this, the way this is written? Or what's weird about it, at least? Exactly. In other words, what's on the left is not a complete molecule. What's on the right is not a complete molecule. We're just focusing on one part of a bigger molecule and what happens to it. So this HCOH with the two unmet bonds, this just represents one of the carbons in the carbon skeleton of glucose, the fuel. But there are six of them, right? But think back to making your glucose model out of the balls and sticks. You had a bunch of hydrogens and OHs hanging off of that. That's what this represents, one of the six carbons and the associated hydrogens, one of which is within a hydroxyl group. Okay. What we haven't talked about at all before now is this second reactant, NAD+. NAD is an acronym. It stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So let's write that out to make sense of it. And nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is another important energy-carrying molecule. We've already talked about ATP a little bit. We'll talk more about it. ATP, as I said a little bit ago, is the ultimate goal. That's where we want to get our energy, in the form of ATP, because it is so versatile. We can spend ATP on many, many different kinds of endergonic processes. That's why it's the goal. But ATP is not made immediately from the energy that's released by our fuels. Instead, that energy is temporarily carried by energy-carrying molecules, including, most importantly, NAD. And therefore, by analogy, I want you to think of NAD as a little energy taxi. Think about what a real taxi in a city does. It's busy all the time, shuttling passengers around, right? No passenger stays in a taxi for very long. Instead, the taxi picks up a passenger, takes it to a destination, drops the passenger off. That empties the taxi, allowing it to now pick up a new passenger if it's available. Over and over. That's what these NAD molecules do. They pick up passengers in the form of electrons and protons. Those are the passengers. And those electrons and protons come from fuel. Now, the original fuel is glucose, but as we'll see, it gets turned into other things as you pick more and more electrons and protons off of it. Those intermediates are still fuel because they're still valuable sources of energy. They're just no longer glucose. Glucose is the fully charged fuel, and then we'll turn it into partially spent fuels along the way. But anyway, I've said today that we oxidize our fuels. What that means is that we're picking off electrons, but we're picking off more than just electrons. We're picking off hydrogen atoms. And when we pick off a hydrogen atom, well, what is a hydrogen atom in terms of subatomic particles? A hydrogen atom is an electron?
You're saying in terms of subatomic particles?
Right. If I just want you to tell me the subatomic particles that you have, if you have a hydrogen atom, what is it? A proton and an electron. Exactly. That's what gets picked off, not just the electron. So yes, it's true that we're picking off a hydrogen atom, but I want you to think of them separately, the proton and the electron separately. They're two individual pieces that are going to take different paths in this process. So think about picking off subatomic particles, protons and electrons, from the fuel. Okay? NAD, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, is a taxi, as I said. Well, there's millions and millions of these same taxis, these NADs. And as we'll see later, there's a different cab company, a different kind of taxi doing the same kind of job called FAD. We'll talk about that later. But there's a whole fleet of these NADs. And just like in a fleet of taxis in a city, some of them at any given moment are going to be full of passengers and some of them are going to be empty. Okay, now the passengers, I said, include electrons. And I just told you a little bit ago that you should think of the electrons that come from the fuel as representing energy from that fuel, right? So, a taxi that is full, one of these NAD taxis that's full, is carrying energy in the form of electrons. And therefore, a full taxi has a lot more energy in it than an empty taxi. But in terms of redox, there are two different forms of... I mean, yes, we can say empty taxi and full taxi, but the proper usage of language in chemistry would be to say that when an NAD plus picks up protons and electrons, what happens to it chemically? What is happening to the NAD, the taxi, when it picks up electrons? It's becoming reduced. Exactly. The fuel is becoming oxidized because that's what's losing the electrons and protons. The taxi is picking them up. So the taxi is becoming reduced. So every individual NAD can go back and forth, just like a real taxi, between empty and full. But the full taxi, always remember, is the reduced version of the molecule. That's the one carrying the energy passengers, electrons and protons. The oxidized version of the taxi is the empty taxi. In the case of NAD, the oxidized form is NAD+. All right. So, as an empty taxi, notice that it has a positive charge. All right. Now, when we pick off hydrogens, we do it in pairs, which is why we're looking at this single carbon that is associated with two different hydrogen atoms. Now, if you have two hydrogen atoms, what do you have as a collection of subatomic particles? Two protons and two electrons. That's what we're stripping from the fuel. Two electrons, two protons. Okay. One of those two electrons, if it gets added to the taxi, NAD+, that's going to just turn it into NAD. Is that clear? Because you're adding a negative to something that's positive. All right, that leaves you with three other passengers. The other electron plus two protons that haven't yet gotten in. That other electron plus one of the protons considered together is a hydrogen atom, right? So when they get in, it turns it into NADH. And that leaves one proton left over that can't fit in the taxi, basically. It's still, and that's why it's listed here. So that, this is why books will say that the reduced version of NAD is NADH plus H+. The proton, the H+, is on its own in solution. It's not actually riding in the taxi. But it's here for accounting purposes. It came from the fuel. You follow me on all this? The oxidized form is NAD+. That's the empty taxi. That's necessary in order to pick up electrons and protons from the fuel. We're picking hydrogens off of fuel to get energy out of that fuel. But we have to be able to put them somewhere. And that somewhere are these taxis, the NADs. All right, so a reduced taxi, a reduced NAD, I call them taxis by analogy, but chemically speaking, they are examples of coenzymes. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is a coenzyme. It's not the only one, but it's an important one. Coenzymes carry something from one place to another in a biochemical process. That's exactly what these are doing. Okay? Well, reduced coenzymes are carrying a lot of energy, not only compared to the oxidized form, which is the empty taxi, but a single NADH is carrying so much energy that it's enough to actually make multiple ATP molecules. Now, just like a taxi, they don't hang on to their passengers, they deliver them. And so what we'll see eventually is that all of these electrons and protons that get picked up from the fuels get driven by these taxis to a place where there is an ultimate payoff in the energy they're carrying in terms of producing a bunch of ATP molecules. Okay, that's... I didn't mention anything about the word above the arrow. What do you know about this word above the arrow? It's an enzyme. There's two ways you can know that. What are those?
The ASE.
ASE? So linguistically, you know it's an enzyme. How else? Right. It's not on either end of the arrow. It's above it in this case because enzymes are catalysts. Catalysts are not reactants or products. Okay, good. Let's go to 7 now. Now we can look at a picture of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And notice the double arrows here, representing the fact that These things go back and forth between oxidized and reduced form, just like taxis go back and forth between full and empty. But on the left, we see the oxidized form, and actually all this stuff in blue is over here on the right as well. They just didn't bother to draw it again. But let's look at this blue box to make sense of the name of this thing. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, first of all, is a dinucleotide, which simply means two nucleotides hooked together. Remember that a single nucleotide is a pentose sugar with a nitrogenous base hooked one place and also at least one phosphate hooked to it. So just this bottom part, the green ribose, the gold adenine, and this phosphate, just if that were by itself, that would be AMP, adenosine monophosphate. Because the nitrogenous base and the sugar together is a nucleoside called adenosine. Well, I gave you five names of nitrogenous bases that are used most often in nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. But they're not the only possible nitrogenous bases. In white here, we have a different nitrogenous base called nicotinamide. All right? And if all you had was the nicotinamide connected to this ribose, which is also connected to this phosphate, then this by itself would also be a nucleotide. But they're hooked together, the two nucleotides, by their phosphates. And therefore, this overall thing is a dinucleotide named for its two nitrogenous bases. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. That explains the name, and that's the structure of the overall taxi, basically. But the business end of this thing, as far as, I guess it would be the back seat, where the passengers come in and get out, is the nicotinamide part of it. And in the oxidized form, remember, there's a positive charge. You can see that here. This is why the empty version, the oxidized form, is NAD+. So as I was saying before, you have two electrons and two protons to work with. One of those is going to make it neutral, gets rid of the positive charge. Another electron and a proton together give it a hydrogen, and that leaves one proton by itself in solution. So there's a pool of protons in the solution all the time, just like there's a pool of inorganic phosphates in the intracellular fluid all the time. All right. Oh, I didn't talk enough about the enzyme. I should have in the last slide, but it's still here, dehydrogenase. We were just talking about the fact that you can tell it's an enzyme, but I didn't explain the reason for it. Remember I said that in addition to knowing that an enzyme is an enzyme because it ends in ASE usually, I also said that, I think I told you, that most enzymes are named in one of two ways, either for what they do or for the substrate that they act on. We looked at sucrase, for instance, that was named for its substrate. Here we have one that's named for what it does. Dehydrogenase is an enzyme responsible for dehydrogenating a fuel, which simply means removing hydrogen from the fuel. To dehydrogenate means to pick the hydrogens off, and that's how we get the energy out of the fuel. So with the enzyme's help, the taxi gets loaded. All right, now eight. I've talked about this before, but it's good to look at the picture. It is possible to burn a fuel all in one step with a combustion reaction. This is not an organic fuel. This is hydrogen, so there's no carbon in it, but hydrogen is an excellent fuel by itself, which is why the Hindenburg exploded. They used hydrogen instead of helium because the United States was hogging all the helium during the war. Anyway, if you put flame to hydrogen in the presence of oxygen, you'll get an explosive release of heat and light, and water is the only There is no carbon in this fuel, so you don't get carbon dioxide. You just get water. That would kill the cell, as I said. But instead, we take the hydrogen, not as hydrogen gas, like it is here, but hydrogen that's part of a bigger fuel molecule. The hydrogens that we're picking off are really the source of the energy, just like if it were hydrogen gas by itself. And instead of doing that all in one step, we do it in several different steps, including part of the process within cellular respiration, which we haven't gotten to yet, called the electron transport chains. That's really where the stepwise release of energy takes place. And notice that allows for the production of a bunch of ATP. So we haven't studied this yet. We're kind of ahead of ourselves, but this is where we are headed. And what you see here is that even though you're doing it in several steps, there is an exactly equal delta G. The difference between here and here in doing it in steps is the same as doing it all in one big step. Just as much energy is released in total. Now in 9, we can finally get to the particulars of this overall process. And this is a summary slide. So this is kind of just a map of where we're going to go. We're not looking at the detail yet. But what we see on this is what I've already written in outline form. The overall process is represented here in this picture, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. It consists of two major parts. The first one to happen is glycolysis, the teal box here. The second major part is cellular respiration, which is happening in the mitochondrion. So glycolysis does not occur in a mitochondrion. And by the way, cellular respiration was invented by bacteria, remember? That's how we got mitochondria. So in a bacterium, the same stuff happens, but it happens in that one compartment that the bacterium has. In a eukaryote, which is what we're studying this in, these two parts of the complete oxidation of glucose occur in different compartments. The glycolysis, which can be called the glycolytic pathway, because it's not one step. There are 10 steps just within glycolysis. All of that happens out in the cytoplasm, inside the cell, but not within a mitochondrion. That's what the brown or ecru background is here. The cytoplasm. Okay, the second major part is cellular respiration. Now, some books will claim that glycolysis is part of cellular respiration. That's actually not true. Glycolysis happens in a cell whether a cell is capable of cellular respiration or not. Not all cells are able to do cellular respiration. And even in cells that can, like our own, sometimes glycolysis occurs without any cellular respiration happening after it. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So that's why I say that that makes it such a point of saying that the complete process is complete oxidation of glucose. Glycolysis is part of that. It happens first, and it happens in the cytosol, the liquid fluid of the cytoplasm. And then after glycolysis, cellular respiration will occur if the cell is capable of it. And that occurs in a eukaryotic cell in the mitochondrion. Okay? Now, those are the two major parts of the complete process. Glycolysis has 10 steps, but I'm not going to name them, list them here by name. It's a 10-step biochemical pathway. We'll look at it in a minute. Cellular respiration, which is already just part B of the overall process, that occurs in three major parts. which are shown here. Well, two of them are shown here at least. So indent below cellular respiration, and you can put the three components of cellular respiration. And the order in which they occur, the first part, is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And I'll explain this in a minute. After that, part two of cellular respiration is the citric acid cycle. That one is shown in the figure. And then the third is oxidative phosphorylation, also shown in the map here. Okay. Now, oxidative phosphorylation, which in the general scheme is part three of part two of the overall process, is itself broken into two parts, which you see here in the purple box. Oxidative phosphorylation consists of electron transport and chemiosmosis. Okay, those are the names of all these parts. And they happen in this order that I've listed them, if they all happen. Let's start, though, with glycolysis. The details aren't shown here. I told you that glycolysis is a pathway that includes 10 reactions, end to end. We'll look at that in a little bit. But this is just a quick summary of it. The multiple arrows here represent the fact that it's not just one reaction, it's many. But it has a starting point and an ending point, just like A to D in that pathways slide I showed you earlier. There are three inputs into glycolysis. One input is the fuel itself, which is glucose. Another thing that you need to put into it is oxidized coenzymes, because the fuel is worthless unless you have taxis that you can load with these passengers you're taking off of the fuel. So you have to have oxidized coenzymes, and empty taxis in other words, and that's what NAD plus is. It's not shown here. You have to put in NAD plus to pick up the hydrogens from the fuel. That's the second material input into glycolysis. And third, you have to input ADP, because the goal, remember, of this whole thing is to make ATP. Well, you convert ADP to ATP when you have the energy to be able to do that. And so that's why ATP is coming out, but what's coming in, not shown, is ADP. And it gets turned into ATP. All right? So the three material inputs, glucose, NAD+, and ADP. After 10 steps, the outputs are ATP, along with reduced coenzymes, full taxis in other words, which is NADH and H+, and also what is left of the fuel after picking off some of the hydrogens. That partially spent fuel, which is the end of glycolysis, which is what spits out at the end of glycolysis, is pyruvate. I call it partially spent fuel because even though glycolysis is done, pyruvate still has valuable carbon-hydrogen bonds in it. It's still something you can get more energy out of. It just doesn't have as much energy as glucose anymore. Well, where did the energy go? Because of the second law of thermodynamics, some of it was wasted as heat. Some of it, though, got invested in the form of ATP, which is the goal. So this ATP that's produced by glycolysis, that doesn't have to be modified. That's already the final goal form. And some of the energy, a lot of it, got invested in the form of these reduced coenzymes, these full taxis. NADH, as I said before, is carrying more energy than multiple ATPs are. So this is a valuable thing, these full taxis. It's just not in the final version yet. ATP is what we want it to be in. Okay, so the pyruvate is what's left of the fuel. And if a cell conducts only glycolysis and stops there, it will produce some ATP, which is its goal, but not nearly as much as it can if it continues processing what's left of the fuel, the pyruvate. And that is exactly what cellular respiration is. A way to extract the rest of the usable energy from the spent fuel, partially spent fuel, pyruvate, that glycolysis spits out. That's why the input into cellular respiration is pyruvate, the output of glycolysis. Okay, before we go to glycolysis, though, in this slide, notice that below this ATP bubble is written the phrase substrate level phosphorylation. The ATP that's produced during glycolysis is produced in a way that's called substrate level phosphorylation. Phosphorylation simply refers to hooking a phosphate onto something, and what gets phosphorylated in this case is ADP, right? When you phosphorylate ADP, you turn it into ATP because you're adding in an extra phosphate. Well, that's how it's produced, and I'll explain with a picture what substrate level phosphorylation is. But notice that in the third part of cellular respiration, which we haven't gotten to yet, the ATP that's produced there is via oxidative phosphorylation, which makes the same stuff. ATP is ATP, no matter how it's formed. But oxidative phosphorylation occurs a little bit differently, not involving a substrate like this does. Okay, so we've made a little bit of ATP. Most of the energy from the fuel is in the form of NADH at this point, and pyruvate, which is still valuable fuel. And we've lost some as energy, or as heat. Now this white arrow between glycolysis and the mitochondrion is not labeled, but that white arrow represents the first part of cellular respiration, which I've already told you is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Cellular respiration occurs within a mitochondrion. Glycolysis happened out in the cytosol. So part of this first step in cellular respiration is the importation of the pyruvate, which is out in the cytosol, into the mitochondrion. That is part of the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, but it's more than just entering the mitochondrion. It gets chemically changed, and that's what the oxidative decarboxylation part of the phrase is all about. I'll show you that in detail in a different slide. But notice that no ATP gets produced in that first part of cellular respiration. Oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate does not produce any ATP. Not shown here, but it is true that it does, though, produce some NADH, some reduced coenzyme, which is even more valuable than ATP. Okay, part two of cellular respiration is the citric acid cycle. And that's one of its names. Eponymously, meaning named after some human, it's called the Krebs cycle. You might have heard of that. Same thing. Or it can also be known as the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Which is often abbreviated TCA cycle. Depends on who you ask. If you ask a student, they'll probably call it the Krebs cycle because it's the easiest to pronounce. Most biologists would call it the citric acid cycle. Most biochemists would call it a tricarboxylic acid cycle. They all are interchangeable. They refer to the same thing. And what you see here in just this low detail summary is that the citric acid cycle also produces some ATP, and the ATP that's produced by the citric acid cycle is also, just like glycolysis, produced via substrate level phosphorylation. But in addition to ATP, the citric acid cycle produces reduced coenzymes. Not only more NADH, NH+, but also a different coenzyme. This would be the second fleet of taxis, a competing company. FADH2 is a different coenzyme. Well, I should call it FAD. FADH2 is the reduced version of it. But FAD is very related, not only in name but in structure, except instead of using nicotinamide, it uses a different nitrogenous base called flavin, which is why it's FAD is short for flavin adenine dinucleotide. They do the same job, though. They pick up electrons and protons, hydrogen, from the fuel. Okay, that's part two of cellular respiration. And then, by this point, we've done a lot of processing of the fuel. And the fuel, what's left of it, well, I should back up a second. There is nothing left of the fuel by the time the citric acid cycle is complete. So a major thing that the citric acid cycle does is to complete the oxidation of what remains of the fuel at that time. If we want to completely spend the fuel to extract as much energy as possible from it, there's two major things that we're doing. We're dismantling the carbon skeleton, which started out as a 6-carbon skeleton, right, in glucose originally. So completely dismantling it means that all of 6 carbons are going to be on their own, not connected to each other anymore. Plus, the second major thing that we do is to pick off all of the hydrogens from that carbon skeleton. All right? Well, glycolysis, the first part of the process, partially accomplishes that. I didn't mention this before, but probably should have. Glycolysis breaks a 6-carbon compound, glucose, into 2 3-carbon compounds. Pyruvate is a 3-carbon compound. So that's part of the dismantling, although a 3-carbon compound still has a carbon skeleton. And along the way, some of the hydrogen has been removed. But each pyruvate not only has 3 carbons, it also has hydrogens. Okay, by the time we get to the citric acid cycle, all of the carbons have been separated from each other. So that's complete dismantling. And all of the hydrogens have been removed. And that's why the only thing that's left, which you can think of as completely spent fuel, worthless in terms of energy, is carbon dioxide, which is one of the 2 products that you'll get if you just burn the glucose directly with a flame. Okay? So no fuel is left after the citric acid cycle, but it's not the end of the process. All of the energy that's usable has been removed from the fuel. But we've only made a little bit of ATP, which is the goal. So at that point, most of the usable energy that is no longer in the fuel is in the form of reduced coenzymes. Some of them NADH from glycolysis, some of it NADH from citric acid cycle, and some of it FADH2, also from the citric acid cycle. Those full taxis, those reduced coenzymes, are carrying a hell of a lot of energy that can be put to use making a lot more ATP than has already been made. That's why this bubble around ATP here is bigger. It's not chemically any different from the ATP already produced. This just represents there's a hell of a lot more of it. Okay? Well, that's why we need this step after citric acid cycle, after the fuel is already gone. And that third major part is oxidative phosphorylation. That's the big payoff in terms of energy. You can think of it as the destination that all of these taxis in two different fleets, NAD and FAD, are driving to drop those electrons off, electrons and protons. All right? They drop the electrons off to structures called electron transport chains, and that allows, as we'll see the details of later, for a lot more ADPs to get turned into ATP. And that happens a little bit differently, and that's why it's called oxidative phosphorylation. But once you make the ATP, it doesn't matter how it was produced. It's carrying the same amount of energy. The fact that there is so much more ATP produced in cellular respiration compared to just stopping after glycolysis is why if a cell is capable of cellular respiration, it will definitely want to continue on after glycolysis. But all cells will perform glycolysis no matter what, or die. And depending on the situation, meaning depending on whether it even has a mitochondrion, or even if it does, depending on the availability of oxygen, it will go on to the cellular respiration parts as well. Because it's just a lot more efficient. For each glycolysis that you start with as a fuel, you can produce a lot more ATP if you, in addition to glycolysis, do cellular respiration. Okay, now to 10. Here we can see a picture that explains what substrate level phosphorylation means. So remember in that previous picture we saw that the ATP that's produced in glycolysis and the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle of cellular respiration are produced this way via substrate level phosphorylation. Well, the name by itself, before you even got a picture, should have told you that a substrate is involved, right? And what is a substrate in general? It is a ligand, but I mean specifically, what is a substrate? How would you define substrate? Well, it would be good to define it the way I told you the definition is.
Is it a reactant?
It's a reactant, but it's more than just that. What kind of reactant? What kind of reaction is it a reactant in? What does a substrate do in a reaction that involves a substrate? No, the protein does. Substrate is a reactant in a catalyzed reaction. A catalyzed reaction involves a catalyst, right? So a substrate is simply the thing that binds to the enzyme, which is the catalyst. All right? That's all substrate means for these biochemistry contexts. A substrate is the thing that binds to the enzyme if it's there. Well, in substrate level phosphorylation, what we have is a phosphorylated substrate. The green thing is, at the moment, carrying a phosphate. ADP also binds to the active site along with the substrate. And because of the conformational change that occurs to the enzyme, the phosphate gets transferred from the substrate to ADP to turn the ADP into ATP. And now you have a and dephosphorylated substrate that comes out as product. So it's a transfer of phosphate from a substrate with the help of an enzyme to ADP. That's all substrate level phosphorylation is. We'll see later when we look at oxidative phosphorylation that that's not how it happens for that, for those ATPs, but it's the same ATP that's produced in both cases. All right. Now we can go to 11 and start looking at the particulars of glycolysis. The glycolytic pathway, or glycolysis, is 10 steps long, 10 individual reactions hooked end-to-end as a biochemical pathway. And those 10 steps are not shown here in detail. But what we have here are two major boxes on the top. The bottom is just a the bottom line, basically. But these two top boxes indicate that although there are 10 steps to glycolysis, you can think of glycolysis as occurring in two phases with respect to energy. So the first of those phases is the so-called energy investment phase. After that, you have an energy payoff phase. Think about the goal here. The goal is to produce ATP, right? Well, the energy investment phase does not only does it not produce ATP, it spends ATP. It requires ATP to be spent. That's why it's called energy investment. By analogy with money, it's kind of like the adage, it takes money to make money. Right? You have to have money that you invest to make even more money in the long run. So even though we're doing exactly the opposite of what we want to do, we want to make ATP, but we're spending it here, that's the only way that we can get the rest of the pathway to work. And it's worth doing that because even though we use two ATPs in the energy investment phase for every glucose, so these are per glucose numbers, even though we spend two per glucose, in the energy investment phase, we're actually going to get four ATPs out, which means that the net increase is two ATPs. Took two, but we make four. All right, that's why on the net down here, you have two ATPs coming out. Well, that's why these are called investment and payoff phases, but I don't want you to overlook the fact that the payoff is in terms of more than just ATP. Yes, we do make two net ATP per glucose, and that's the goal. That doesn't need to be processed. That ATP that's produced in glycolysis doesn't need to go through the rest of the process. It's just ready to go to be used to drive whatever endergonic processes the cell needs. It's the fuel that needs to be further processed, and also the taxis, the coenzymes that are carrying a lot of energy also need to be processed. But that's reduced coenzymes is another big payoff of the energy payoff phase. In addition to the ATP, we are reducing more NAD plus into NADH, NH plus. Okay, so these two NADs that are NADHs that are produced per glucose, much more valuable than the two ATPs. It's just that they need to be further processed to get them in the form of ATP, or to get the energy in the form of ATP. So that is an overall summary. Let's go to 12 and look at greater detail. This isn't all of glycolysis in slide 12. This is the energy investment phase. It's the first half, basically, the first several reactions. You can see the reactions numbered here in blue. And glucose, is at the top because that's the input as fuel. Glucose is a six-carbon compound with a bunch of hydrogens in it. That's why it's valuable. And immediately, we can see that we need ATP in order for this thing to proceed through the pathway. So that's part of the energy investment.
It takes an ATP to transform glucose into glucose-6-phosphate.
Glucose-6-phosphate gets its name simply because it's glucose with a phosphate hooked to its sixth carbon.
This is carbon 6.
That's where the phosphate is. Where does that phosphate come from? ATP. ATP drops one of its phosphates off to the fuel to turn it into glucose-6-phosphate. That energizes the fuel so that it can then go through the rest of the process. Okay? Notice that you have hexokinase here. That's the specific enzyme that catalyzes just this first step of glycolysis. Okay. Kinases, by the way, that's a real big category of enzymes. There's all kinds of kinases. Kinases in general, though, are enzymes that phosphorylate other things. In this case, the glucose gets phosphorylated. And glucose is a hexose. That's why it's called hexokinase. Well, anyway, we have not, even though we no longer have glucose, we have not at all dismantled it or taken any hydrogens off of it. We've just energized it with this phosphate. In the next step, we don't do any of dismantling or dehydrogenation either. But we rearrange the carbon skeleton. We turn it into an isomer, which is fructose-6-phosphate. It's a different hexose. All right? Then we need another ATP. This is why it was 2 ATP per glucose that have to be invested. But they're invested at different parts along the pathway. And that will turn this into fructose-1,6-bisphosphate because it's now doubly phosphorylated. There's a phosphate connected to the first and the sixth carbons. All right, then you get to this fork in the road. And the reason it's a fork is because the next step has two possible products, and you never know which you're going to get. They're both almost equally probable. More about that in a second, but this fork in the road, when you process fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, that is when you finally start dismantling this thing. Okay, so we still have a 6-carbon skeleton here with all of its hydrogens still attached. Now we're going to break that 6-carbon compound, which is a fuel, it's just no longer glucose, into 2 3-carbon compounds. But there's two possible ways this can happen. You can produce either dihydroxyacetone phosphate, shown here, or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is often abbreviated as G3P. All right? Now, notice that there is a white arrow under glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, but there isn't one under dihydroxyacetone phosphate. That little white arrow refers to the fact that glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate can get to the rest of the pathway, which is on the next slide. But this one can't. And I told you that the cell doesn't know which one's going to be made. It's kind of it's like flipping a coin, basically. Even though only one can proceed to the other, to the rest of the pathway, which is where the payoff is, it doesn't matter if dihydroxyacetone phosphate is produced instead, because it can then easily be made into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. That's what these horizontal arrows are for. They're both 3-carbon compounds. They both have exactly the same chemical formula, which means they're isomers of each other, right? And that's why the enzyme responsible for turning dihydroxyacetone phosphate into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is called isomerase. It isomerizes this into its other form. And then that means, so even though some of this is produced, effectively all of it becomes the useful stuff, G3P, which then goes on to the rest of the pathway. I should have been using a close-up here. Shows you much better detail, but it's just the same thing. Okay, now, not only have we dismantled this a little bit, so we have 2 3-carbon compounds, each of them is individually phosphorylated, though, which allows them to have their payoff on the next steps. An important point before we get to these next steps, though, is that these numbers that we've been studying in terms of how much ATP is required or produced, those I said are per glucose. Well, now we no longer have glucose. Instead, for each glucose, we have two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates. And so everything we see for in the next slide, everything we see that going through, you have to multiply by two, because there's two of those for every glucose that you started with. 13 is the energy payoff phase. So we're starting with that G3P that came from above. And in this first step, notice there's already a payoff. NAD plus, which is what kind of coenzyme? Which version? In terms of energy, it's the oxidized form, which is what? Low energy or high energy? That's the low energy, empty taxi. It's driving in and picking up two hydrogens that are being picked off of that fuel. That's why the taxi, the coenzyme, is becoming reduced. It's picking up energetic passengers. It's becoming NADH and H+, the reduced form. That energy that it's carrying was in the fuel no longer is. The fuel has become partially oxidized. So it's partially spent fuel at that point. All right. Then in the next step, we have more payoff. This is why the two comes from, though. It's one for each of the two G3Ps that came from the previous steps. It's not that there are two driving in. It's one per molecule, but there are two molecules at this point. But then in the next step, we have ATP produced. ADP comes in. It gets phosphorylated. And that is the goal, right? ATP. Then you have some steps that transform it into other stuff along the way that are required in order for those steps to happen, but there isn't any more energy, useful energy coming out. There's some has lost its heat at every step, of course. And then we finally get to another ATP step. So there's two up here, two down here, four total, but we spent two in the investment phase, and that's why per glucose, it's a payoff of two net. But that's not the big payoff. The bigger payoff is that we've made some NADHs and H+. And those are even more valuable than the ATP. In terms of the fuel, though, what we have is pyruvate. Still valuable stuff because it has hydrogens that can still be picked off. And it also can be dismantled. Carbon-carbon bonds are valuable, too, for the same reason as carbon-hydrogen bonds. So that's why dismantling is a big part of it as well. Pyruvate is only partially spent fuel, and therefore if you stop there, you're just wasting some of the energy. But that's glycolysis. Glycolysis ends at pyruvate. And there are two of them for each glucose because each pyruvate is 3-carbon, whereas a glucose to start with is a 6-carbon. All right, so remind me that we are on 14 when I start again.